12 after the top of the hour. Dr. Taylor, good morning. Dr. Taylor?
Yes.
Good morning, sir.
How are you?
Excellent. Let me ask you your opinion of Beyonce's album before we get into what you want to talk about.
I haven't heard it yet. You know, I haven't heard it yet. But I talked to some people yesterday at dinner at Easter, and they were talking about how great it was. So I'm looking forward to listening to it. And I appreciate the previous conversation about the way in which there's this overlap and these sort of borrowings and samplings of music, because it goes back, you know, very far. And one of the things that wasn't mentioned is that Marvin Gaye's birthday is actually tomorrow as well. He was killed on April Fool's, and I remember being on a bus with a choir in Philadelphia when I was going to junior college, and we were all on the bus, about 40 of us, and we were sleeping, and then somebody said Marvin Gaye was dead, and we assumed because of April Fool's, it was a joke as well. But it also is true that Marvin Gaye's birthday, his 45th birthday, was going to be the next day, April 2nd, and that's when he was shot by his father, who had his own, apparently, you know, issues with cross-dressing in Washington, D.C., and Marvin Gaye got bullied because his father had this sort of sexual confusion, because he was a minister, but he walked around in women's clothing sometimes, and over time, you know, Marvin Gaye even added an E to his name because he and his father never found peace. They never found a good place in their relationship over 40 years. And so Marvin Gaye added an E to his name, one to honor Sam Cooke, but the other, you know, to distinguish from his father. And there was this whole question about his sexuality and his father's sexuality. So there was a lot going on with Marvin Gaye and his father. And we all know Marvin was one of the greatest soul men, soul singers, you know, of all time. He and Curtis Mayfield, Donny Hathaway, you know, some of the large groups. Those were special times. The music to this day uplifts the people. You know, Marvin Gaye's music continues to ask important social justice questions, like what's going on will always be a question that Black people will you know, be able to express. Make me want to holler and throw up both my hands. I promise you, thousands of us feel that way this morning.
You sure do. And hold that thought right there, Doc. We got to take a quick break here. We come back and get into some of the issues that you want to talk to. Dr. James Taylor is with us, folks. He's a Black politics expert. He's a political scientist by trade. We're going to talk politics with him. If you have questions about politics, hit us up at 800-450-7876. Your phone calls in 4 minutes right here in Baltimore on 1010 WLB. If you're in the DMV, we're on FM 95.9 and AM 1450 WOL, where information is power. Happy Monday, family. 21 minutes away from the top of the hour. It's April 1st. Our guest is Dr. James Taylor. Dr. Taylor is a Black politics expert. Before we go back, you know, let me just remind you, coming up later this week, you're going to hear from Morgan State Professor Dr. Ray Wimbush. Reparations advocate Cam Howard will be here. And also medical doctor and scientist Dr. Velma Bowles will also join us. So make sure your radio is locked in tight on 1010 WLB if you're in Baltimore. If you're in the DMV, we're on 95.9 and AM 1450 WOL. So Dr. Taylor, my question, the summit we had in Gary in 72, all our Black leaders were there from all strata, social, political as well. And the questions we were asking in Gary, it seems like we're still asking the same questions today. Have we made any progress?
Well, I think if you consider a Black president progress, then we've already achieved that. And that in 1972 was definitely what Black people were considering. Again, the question was, what direction will we go in? We've been at the stage of protest, and now we have to move to politics. That's an article from Bayard Rustin, who was the intellectual and organizing leader of the civil rights movement. He said we have to move from protest to politics in 1965, and that was a call for Black intellectuals, the Democratic left, the New Deal Democratic Black, you know, base, to get into the game of internal politics. And that's when the 1965 Voting Rights Act enhances the number of Black elected officials from a few hundred around the country to over 10,000 before 1985. So I'm saying within 20 years, from 65 to 85, that's the first real, and 85 is the first real full generation of Black people with the right to vote. Women black women, again, to show you I'm not a sexist because I don't jump on the, what's her name, Shirley Chisholm back bandwagon, black women didn't get the rights until 1965 with the Voting Rights Act, with the activities of King. So, you know, it's new for black men, it's new for black women. Shirley Chisholm had her own agenda, and she did not support the agenda of the established black leadership. But again, for those who are quick to, you know, throw out gender and sexuality and see her as an audacious black woman who, you know, wanted, who black men wanted to silence, we're talking about a time period. We're talking about before the sexual revolution. We're talking about before the feminist revolution. It may even be a part of it. But that's not how it was understood at the time. Black women like Ella Baker, Fannie Lou Hamer, Coretta Scott King did not endorse Shirley Chisholm, and they had their own strategy. Ella Baker and Fannie Lou Hamer had shown 8 years earlier in 1964 their strategy, which was again another attempt. What do we do? In 64, they ran in the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party against the racist white Mississippi Democrats and won. And then because of LBJ and the Democratic leadership, including Martin Luther King, they undermined those seats that the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party delegation won and gave them two symbolic seats. And, you know, everybody was upset about what happened in 64. And that in part led to the call for Gary, Indiana. We should have had more Garys. We did try again for 9 years between 72 and 81. There were meetings in Arkansas, Philadelphia, and Atlanta trying to organize a independent black political strategy. And that's the tragedy of that time, because Ronald Walters, the great political scientist at Howard and the University of Maryland, who was behind Jesse's strategy in 84, he told Jesse to run an independent party run in 84, go independent. Lenora Falani did it many years later, and Lenora Falani doesn't get talked about enough. Lenora Falani in 92 was one of the first candidates of an independent black party to get on all 50 state ballots, and was on the ballot in 92 when Clinton beat Bush, the father, in 92. So Lenora Falani gave us an example of what could be done. She ran a third party independent strategy, but it was out of an independent black politics that she was operating in. Again, Shirley Chisholm wanted the benefit of what black people had achieved up to that point in terms of opening up the opportunity structures for men and for women, but especially for men at that time. And, you know, she wanted to insert a different kind of politics, a personal politics that would boost her up. And now, again, she basically beat all the other sisters to the line and even white women to the line. So now we're talking about Shirley Chisholm. But what can we point to that she achieved other than getting notarized as a black woman with an attitude or audacity, should I say, who decided to run for president against the will of the political establishment? You can dismiss the political establishment, but at this moment, it's emergent. It's trying to figure itself out. It's trying to understand what its capacities are. What does it mean that we have 10,000 black elected officials? What does it mean that we now have the Congressional Black Caucus? You know, we have black mayors, Gary, Indiana, Richard, Mayor Hatcher was the mayor. You know, we're talking about where Michael Jackson and the Jackson family are born. Gary, Indiana, where plenty of black folk live. Terre Haute and Gary and other parts of Indiana. And so, again, it was an opportunity lost. If we could do 1972 all over again and ask, because it wasn't just her. And Mary Baraka's ego was out of check, too. So, yeah, Shirley Chisholm's ego and Mary Baraka's ego. Those two egos were the main reason why we've been confused ever since 1972, because she had her agenda and Amiri Baraka had his agenda. He wanted revolution. She wanted more Democratic Party politics. And those two positions right there are largely the confusion of what has happened to us since. The only thing we've been able to do, Carl, since is just be good Democrats. That's what we've done. Be good Democrats. So we haven't figured out a black agenda the way we were trying to in this 10 years between Gary and, I want to say, MBIP the National Black Independent Party idea. So it wasn't like black people didn't try. If you go back to the 1800s, the 1850s, 60s, 70s, 80s, we had a bunch of independent local black parties. In Alabama, in Loudoun County, right? Black people had the first Black Panther Party. That's where the word Black Panther came from, right? Because they were organizing. In Mississippi, they were organizing. So black people were doing all kinds of politics, Carl. And we can put Shirley Chisholm's moment in there and add it into the gumbo. But she's not more important than anything else in the gumbo. And Mary Baraka, again, with his ego, he sidetracked the entire convention because he wanted revolution and all these new black elected officials. They had white constituencies. They had Democratic constituencies. They had white bosses. So that's where the convention split. It split over Mary Baraka and Shirley Chisholm. So the two of them are really why black people end up becoming better Democrats at a moment when they were poised to create an independent black party.
All right, we got some folks who want to talk to you. We're 13 away from the top there. Let's go to line two. Mike is calling. Money Mike is in Baltimore. Money Mike, Grand Rising, brother. You're on with Dr. Taylor.
Good morning, Carl. Good morning, Dr. Taylor. Dr. Taylor, do you feel that the Democratic Party, the Democratic leadership, has played African Americans since 1960? And also, do you feel that we have to learn the game? We have to pony up money. We shouldn't have to, but that's the way the game is played. We're continuously asked to vote, but we're not asked to finance anybody in political leadership, and that's why we keep getting what we're getting. I'll take your answer off air.
Yeah, I think again,
go ahead, Dr. Taylor.
Oh, no, I was going to say part of the reality is, yeah, you know, since we got the Voting Rights Act in 65, unfortunately, what happened was all of those talented people in Gary, all of the talented emergent, you know, students and black power activists and militants of the 60s and 70s, they became what ends up happening. And there's a lot of scholarship on this. They became better Democrats. That's what ends up happening is we end up becoming more wedded to the Democratic Party as a result of the civil rights movement. And at that point, we were neutral. We weren't Democrats yet. We become Democrats in 64. We were between 32 and 64 is a full generation, 32 years. During that 32 years, we were neither party. We were both. We were in between. We were kind of like Latinos are now. We were a little bit here and a little bit there, mostly Republicans, but we weren't really Republicans. We were always not Republicans. That's how black folk were. We were Republicans, but what we weren't really. I've said this before on your show. There's a history of a bunch of black people in the 1800s who created something called the Black and Tan Republicans. And Black and Tan Republicans was a black party within the white party that basically was not even a Republican party. We were just calling ourselves Republican, but we were living and operating and functioning independently until we embraced the Democrats with the 1964 election between LBJ and Barry Goldwater. And so I would also say, yeah, money is important. Money is the game now. And you see the Jewish lobby, AIPAC, is spending $200 million coming after black politicians viciously because of Palestine, Israel. And we have no defense. And they're going after Cori Bush. And if Cori Bush is voted out, black people, a lot of us on the progressive black left going to be disappointed and demoralized. So if you have money, yes, we need to help the candidates we believe in across the country, not just your local politician, but send money. I'm not saying to the National Democrats. I'm saying send it to Cori Bush, send it to Ayanna Pressley directly. You know, send it to these sisters and these brothers who you believe in. Like anybody else does. But we black people do need to put our money behind our causes and those politicians that we can support. I ain't never gave money to a white politician in my life, as far as I remember. But I've always tried to give a little bit of money whenever I can to help any black politician that I believe in across the country by just sending money to their campaign to help them. Black people have to protect and fight for the ground and progress we've made. And even if you know, the postmortem on Gary isn't as optimistic as everyone would like, because of the decisions and choices made back at that point. I think it's really important to understand we're, you know, like Bayard Rustin said, we've now moved from the stage of protest around King and Black Power and the Panthers to the stage of politics, insider game. And the Congressional Black Caucus is the most representative body for Black people in all of America. It is the main leadership. It's no longer Martin Luther King. It's the Congressional Black Caucus is the elected representative body of Black America at the congressional level, local. So that's different than if you're a senator like Tim Scott in South Carolina. That's the whole state. But at the congressional level, it's at the most immediate and local level. That's why they, you know, call the House of Representatives the people's house, the lower house. And that's where most of the Black Congressional Caucus is, where the people are. So it's not perfect. This system is not perfect. The American political system has a lot of blind spots. And that's where the vulnerabilities are. And whatever our strategies were going to be, we needed to attack those vulnerabilities. And what we did was we decided, for whatever reason, that the only vulnerability was in the Democratic Party and we could take it over. And so what we did is we left the Party of Lincoln in 64 with LBJ, and we've been Democrats ever since, and realigned ourselves with the Democrats. And I don't think it's, you know, there's been some good that's come out of that. But there's also been, I think, a distracted Black politics, where we are thinking, as I always say on your show, the problem I have with Black Democrats is they tend to be Democrat first and Black second. Their agenda is a partisan agenda and not the agenda of the Black community. Very few Black Democrats, including the Congressional Black Caucus, have endorsed reparations. How is that possible? You got New York State, you got California, the two probably most important states in America internationally are at the legislative level. Not in no Black politics, not no militant politics, but at the the elected legislature of New York and California have implemented reparations plans. In California, they're rolling it out. People think we didn't get anything. Watch. We got the infrastructure of reparations in place in California. It's on the table of the governor and the of state representatives, and there are members of the California Congressional Black Caucus. They are endorsing reparations. They are actually going to do something about it. There are leaders in the California Senate who are Black, who are actually saying, you gave us this proposal. We got 1,300 pages. We got all these ideas. Now let's see what we can do. That's where reparations is right now in California, Carl. It's not the answer. People think because there wasn't a big announcement that, yes, that the answer was no. The answer is not no. The answer is now that you got this thing adopted into the legislature. Do you have the resources and politics to make it happen? See, that's the stage now. What we did was we
right. And hold on thought right there, Dr. Taylor. We got to take a quick break. I'll let you finish that thought when you get back. And Bob in Buffalo has a question for you. 6 minutes away from the top of the hour, family. Our guest is Dr. James Taylor. You want to speak to him? Reach out to us at 800-450-7876. And we'll take your phone calls in 4 minutes right here in Baltimore on 1010 WOLB. Also in the DMV, we're on FM 95.9 and AM 1450 WOL for information. And welcome to April, family. It's April 1st, Fool's Day, as they call it. It's a minute after the top there. Our guest, Dr. James Taylor, is a Black politics expert. Dr. Taylor, I'll let you finish your thought, and got some folks got questions for you.
Well, just that, you know, from Gary on, that's the beginning of the post-civil rights, post-segregation period of Black politics. That's the new beginning, 1972 Gary. And we were either going to end up independent or we were going to be better Democrats, or maybe had joined back to the Republicans, but that wasn't an option. But we ended up deciding to be better Democrats. And the full understanding of Gary, you know, again, there's a book called We Have No Leaders. Is the best book that you can get on it. But Howard Cruz, who's my favorite thinker, was there and wrote about the 1974 Arkansas National Black Political Convention that happened 2 years ago, 2 years later in 1974. And he called it a betrayal of the Black militant potential built up in the 1960s. Because again, what Jesse does it says nation time, but Jesse runs to the Democrats. And that kind of links the black agenda to the Democratic Party. That's how we got there. LBJ starts it with the war on poverty and the Great Society incentives. And Jesse largely completes it when he runs. Shirley Chisholm could not have had that effect because she didn't have the support that Jesse conjured up. Jesse had ties directly to King, you know, heir apparent and charismatic minister with deep ties to the civil rights and black political establishment. So Jesse made himself the person of choice. He and Shirley Chisholm had a lot in common, too. He, Shirley Chisholm, and Mary Baraka, all these egos. So the feminists want me to talk nice about Shirley Chisholm, like what she did was not as arrogant as what Baraka did or as arrogant as what Jesse did. But I'm not that person. I'm not that kind of intellectual. I'm not going to sit here and say what I think I'm supposed to say. I'm going to be respectful. But at the same time, I want to highlight the fact that Shirley Chisholm didn't want to play. And the men said, you don't want to play, but you're playing in your own, you know, little pool. Then go ahead, have your own little pool. And yeah, you get to say you ran unbowed and unbossed, whatever that meant at the time. Again, maybe maybe if I was a black woman, I could understand Shirley Chisholm better. But what I saw was the same arrogance that I saw in Jesse to run as a Democrat when Ron Walters said run as an independent. If Jesse Jackson runs an independent party campaign in 1984 instead of a Democrat campaign, we would have our independent black party right now. And Jesse, and here's the deep thing. The Democrats had nothing except insider politics and jobs for the black elected elite or the black elite. The reality is that, you know, the Rainbow Coalition came from the Black Panther Party. The Rainbow Coalition is the idea. That was the coalition ingredients that gave us Jesse Jackson's two campaigns. It also was the basis of Bill Clinton's campaigns and became the basis, although Bill Clinton was much more conservative, but it was also the basis of Barack Obama's election coalition. Who elected Obama? The Rainbow Coalition. What did Jesse Jackson run on? The Rainbow Coalition. Where did Jesse get the idea from? Not the Democrats. He got the idea of the Rainbow Coalition from Fred Hampton and the Black Panther Party in Chicago, where Jesse and Farrakhan and many others were based. So I'm saying that even at this moment of independence, Jesse has to borrow from independent black politics to come up with the rationale for his coalition, and it ends up being Rainbow Coalition. That was black power. The Rainbow Coalition was all colors, but the main color, the rule, R-U-E, the rule, like in gumbo, was black. And that's where Fred Hampton was coming from. He was down with everybody, down with all groups, all orientations, but he never forgot the fundamental importance of black politics driving the Rainbow Coalition. When Jesse runs, Jesse distracts us with his ego. And again, that's what all of them are doing at this time. And Adolf Reed Jr., who is now, I think, retired from the University of Pennsylvania, was very critical of this time period in his book in 1986 called The Jesse Jackson Phenomena. It's an older book now, but it gives you a good understanding of the immediate context of how Jesse and the Democrats become more involved in what Adolf Reed calls brokerage politics. Like, you know, we can play the game. I'm a black leader at the congressional level, and you're the Democratic boss, and you want black votes delivered. I can give that to you. That's brokerage politics. And that's what we end up employing in the post-black power era. We were looking for independent party politics. We ended up becoming strong Democrats, unfortunately, and the independent spirit that drove Gary was lost within 2 years because of all those egos, including Shirley Chisholm.
Hold on right there, Doc, because we got a bunch of folks want to talk to you. Bob's on line three. He's calling from Buffalo. Bob, you're on with Dr. Taylor.
Yes, sir. Blessed love, family. I'd like to have a testimony and a question. The testimony is I was in Gary as a student. We took our own documentation crew there. And things broke down when Charles Diggs miscalled a voice vote and there was a long agenda. There was a long pause.
Was it a floor fight?
Hold on. Say again, sir.
Was it a floor fight? A fight on the floor?
Well, it got to be almost a physical fight, but they basically held everything in pause for a minute. And when it came back, Baraka was in charge. And Baraka mm-hmm. took control of the convention, and it continued on. And Baraka had a phrase in Newark where he said, politics is the gaining, maintaining, and use of power. It wasn't about party politics. Politics is the right. gaining, maintaining, and use of power. My question is, the process that we have right now in terms of having to register to vote keeps people away from the ballot box. What do you think about automatic registration for voting as soon as you turn 18? They know when you turn 18, just like they had when the draft was here. You should automatically be registered and able to vote as soon as you turn 18 in this country. What do you think about that?
I think you're right. I think there's a lot of vote reform that needs to happen. Most of the unfair voting policies are targeted at Black people and young people. I think, you know, we have to realize, again, even though this conversation is about politics, that's not the only front that Black people can use. We have a lot of different avenues. You can, you know, I don't want to start running off of examples, but we have all kinds of civil society areas that need help, from mentoring to senior care to orphans I meant to say foster care. You know, we have a lot of different areas, economic development. We need, you know, we need to enhance our art. We have to figure out how to get control and ownership of our art while we're watching these distractions with, you know, the Black celebrities and their sexual proclivities and habits, you know, being played out, that we're being distracted from that rather than focusing on, you know, a coherent politics. So I agree that, you know, voting, yeah, it should be automatic. We should have a weekend voting. We should have a voter holiday like other countries that have, you know, almost universal vote participation. You know, we're not very good. America is not very good compared to other industrialized nations with voter participation. We're low in terms of how Americans vote. 43% of people are voting, 44%, not 75%. Not 80% of Americans participate. In fact, in 2016, Hillary could have won if Black folk in Detroit, in Michigan, let's say if there was like 400,000 Black people in Michigan, let's say 50,000 came out to support Hillary. If Hillary had just gotten Black people in every big city to come out in larger numbers, she could have flipped entire states like Wisconsin or Pennsylvania. And ultimately, it didn't work out for her. But again, yeah, I think we should understand, though, those who are frustrated with politics should understand there's all kinds of areas that we need attention to: economic, cultural, social, mental. Now we've been through a pandemic. Yeah, we need people, all hands on deck, brother, is what I'm trying to say. All hands on deck. And we're talking about the politics hands, or the hands that were on the politics deck. And politics is important because that's where the game is played, excuse me, where the rules are, and the laws are. But we shouldn't limit our involvement to politics. We should, if you don't like politics, get involved in mentoring or, you know, PAL track or boxing, you know, teaching young boys or girls boxing, or, you know, be a coach or a mentor, you know, do tutoring. There's a lot of things we can do to improve the Black condition apart from politics. And I think many people are frustrated and figure, well, let's see what's going on in the political front before they'll allow themselves to be happy or sad in terms of getting involved. If they're upset that Trump is in power, they might get involved with anger, you know, and really try to, you know, fight back against this Trump thing. And so I think, again, we have many different examples of many different strategies. That's what Gary shows. It was first the Black elected officials were in charge. Then Baraka takes it from them. And Baraka didn't have nobody to worry about voting for him. And all those Black elected officials did. So those Black elected officials, they ran from Gary, ran to the Democratic Party. And sadly for us, I wish there were more women involved in that process, because it would have been pushed longer, further along. But Shirley Chisholm wasn't the one. It was, you know, if Ella Baker or Fannie Lou Hamer were pushing it, we probably would have gotten more because they tried to encourage Gary toward independence, but black people were too afraid, I think, to step out on the independent politic track with confidence because they needed the Democratic Party machine and money. And I think that was a tragic mistake. I think what we should have done is if you want to play with the Democrats nationally, okay, locally, be at war with the Democrats so that nationally the Democrats can't be the conservative party with us in it. But we haven't figured out the best strategy yet. And that's what Gary exposes at the very least. Gary teaches us that, we had a lost opportunity and we've lost it for good because that was the moment. It's just it's not like we can go back and fix it and reset that. It put us on the path politically we are now as Democrats. That's how we got to be solid Democrats. We were in between, but we became solid Democrats between 64 and 72, and in 72 when McGovern runs and gets defeated. That was pretty much the end of our time in the sun until Farrakhan does the Million Man March, but it didn't have any political agenda outside, again, of ego, because Farrakhan achieved the Million Man March, and then he went around calling himself Jesus for these times, and he went around, talking about the mothership and the mother plane, which I do understand as a part of the nation theology, but it wasn't, what black people were thinking about when he went on his world friendship tour. Farrakhan went around the world and congratulated himself for the achievement of the Million Man March rather than following up with the promise he made at the Million Man March. Farrakhan promised in Gary in 72. Farrakhan promised in D.C. in 1995 the creation of a third force by the Nation of Islam. And it has the infrastructure to do it, but because the nation is not committed to politics and politics first, Farrakhan registered to vote in 1983. In 1983, he's born in about 1937, if I'm not mistaken, or 36 or so. Farrakhan registered to vote in 1983 to support Jesse Jackson. That's the first time he registered. So the nation is not, a bastion of, is not ready to become a political party. What I'm saying is it has the infrastructure, the independent mindset, the independent black nationalist thinking. It could, and it could have done it, but they would need a person who's essentially more political than theological, and Farrakhan is deeply theological in terms of the nation's teachings and solidifying those teachings, because when Farrakhan's gone, there aren't too many more people who really understand, the original teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and Master Farad Muhammad. So for that reason, Farrakhan has to, set the nation straight in, going forward. And the question is, if they have a younger, dynamic, politician emerge after Farrakhan, then perhaps the Nation of Islam could become a political party because it does have the infrastructure going back to 1930. The nation is 6 years.
Hold on, we got to take a quick break here. 14 after the top. I'll let you finish up analyzing the nation when we get back. Family, you want to join this conversation, reach out to us at 800-450-7876. Your phone calls in 4 minutes right here in Baltimore on 1010 WLB. If you're in the DMV, we're rolling on FM 95.9 and AM 1450. WOL, where information is power. Happy Monday, family. 21 minutes at the top there with our guest, Dr. James Taylor. Dr. Taylor's a black politics expert. Dr. Taylor, I just got a couple of tweets from some brothers in the nation, and they said you're on point, especially when it comes to politics, what you said about Minister Farrakhan. But we got some folks who want to talk to you. We also wanted to get in, if you could explain why Hollywood is trying to distract black Americans from politics and reparations. We'll do that after we take this call from Christian on line two. He's calling from Malibu. Christian, your question for Dr. Taylor.
Good morning, Dr. Taylor. In November 2006, I bought 16.7 acres here in Malibu. It took about 38 days to complete the process. We were on a committee that met two and a half years, maybe 12 to 15 people. So my question is to you, well, number one, how many acres is California going to appropriate each black person this year? And how much money is California going to appropriate to each black person this year in reparation? That's what I want to know.
Yeah, that's a great question. Those are great questions. First and foremost, again, there are several aspects. One, for example, at the local level in San Francisco. So I speak on two things. San Francisco, that's one level. And then and the cities like L.A. And Oakland and Berkeley and Sacramento all have reparations plans. And then there's the state level, California. So California, the state, is doing four big things. And they're using those four big things as the apparatus to roll out. So the answer to your question is, you're not going to see an all of a sudden announcement that California is giving so much money to elders or people right away. But that's in place. And they have said they are going to try to do it. So, again, this is more about the insider game of politics. How this is when you do need black Democrats in place, but who are black first, not Democrats first, who prioritize a black agenda. And reparations is the original black agenda. Out of all of our agendas, it's the original one. 40 acres and the mule was the first thing we asked for after slavery. So we're clear of reparations' importance. And so in San Francisco, for example, we have a building there in the Fillmore called the 1300 Fillmore. It was a black-owned restaurant, a husband and wife couple, very elegant place. Next to it was a place called Yoshi's, which is a Japanese restaurant. And the Fillmore before internment was black and Japanese. So black developers in San Francisco in the 80s under Willie Brown created a whole space, and it was the same building that the Black Panther Party used to publish their paper, where the San Francisco Sun Reporter paper was published at 1300 Fillmore. So the black community lost it. We had it, and then there was a shooting incident. One night, somebody got killed, and the city took it from us. We got that back through our reparations effort, brother. So nobody can say we got nothing. We got the facility back, and we're talking about a prime piece of property in downtown San Francisco in the black community that is multi-purpose, and it's humongous, and they already have Marcus Books there, like Marcus Garvey Books is already there. There's all kind of programs, and this is what Harold Cruz said had to happen with the Black Power Movement in New York. The Adam Clayton Powell State Building in New York City in Harlem, Cruz said in the 60s, everything black people were doing had to lead to the capturing of that building. We now call the Adam Clayton Powell State Building. When you see Malcolm X in the 60s speaking out in Harlem in the sun, he's usually in front of the building that became the Adam Clayton Powell State Building. Cruz said the black community should have fought Rockefeller and Albany, New York, to fight for that building. Why? It might not seem like a big deal because it's a building, but at the very least, he said you need a base that you can have a multi-purpose facility that, you know, that does training, that is art training, that teaches plays and theater and everything, right? Every aspect of black community can be done at this space. And we rationalized. And there was only two people on that committee that fought for this building, me and Reverend Amos Brown, who was on both the state and the San Francisco committee. We were the two out of the 15 that said, if we can't get that building, which we already had, then we can't get anything. And brother, I'm saying to you, it may not be impressive to you or anybody else, but locally, Black San Francisco got its piece of property back that was very important. It goes back to the Black Panther Party publishing site, and the Sun Reporter is still published as the largest black paper in the West Coast. It's done at this building in 1300 Fillmore. Imagine Elder Cleveland walking in there. See Bobby Seale walking out. Imagine Huey standing there. Oh, look, there's Elaine Brown. Oh, look, there's Kathleen Cleaver. Oh, look, there's Angela Davis. That's what you can imagine at this building I'm talking about. So it's so important. We got that. And we're still trying to get them. They did an apology. The city apologized for all of its abuses, but they didn't give us no money. And that's what we got to fight for, because recently, the Chinese got apologized to during the Asia hate period 2 years ago while we were meeting, like you said, brother, for 2.5 years. And they gave them $50 million and an apology. And ain't nobody asked for it. Ain't nobody asked for no apology or no money, but they got it. London Breed, who's a black woman Democrat, is the main reason why we can't get the money. She has prevented it. And that's what you see everywhere where there's a reparations agenda. There's usually a black politician in the city, in the mayor's office, who was not saying yes. They're all like down in L.A., Karen Bass, up in San Francisco, London Breed. These black in Philadelphia, they got a new sister, mayor, in Boston. All of these cities have reparations mobilizing in the black community, and they have black politicians in place to say no. And London Breed literally killed a $50 million proposal we had to create a committee, a permanent reparations committee in San Francisco. She killed it when we reduced it to $10 million. She killed it again when we reduced it to $2 million. So in San Francisco, the black politicians have killed reparations. One black politician supporting it, the main one, the mayor, would not support reparations, and she went out of her way to make sure she didn't give us any support for infrastructure, and she was doing this trying to please the Chinese community in San Francisco, which opposes reparations. And then the article came out 2 or 3 days ago saying London Breed has lost support of the wealthy in the Chinese community. So she did all of this genuflection and bowing down to Chinese people by not supporting us. And now they not even supporting her. So all that tap dancing she did for the Chinese community against the black community, and that's what's happened here locally, the black politician from the black neighborhood, born and raised, is taking a position against her own people that she loved and grew up with. And that, what's so odd is because she's a favorite daughter, they love her. And at the same time, she does things that are not very progressive in terms of a progressive black agenda. She gives $50 million a year through this thing called the Dream Keepers Initiative, but this was not reparations. And so, yeah, but I probably have taken way too long to answer your question, but the reality is that we have only modest outcomes that we can point to. And the question is, what will happen now? If we give up on reparations as a big idea as a black people, then it's failed. But you can also see that with the recognition of Juneteenth, that's the first time the federal government has recognized slavery or its end apart from the Emancipation Proclamation and the 13th Amendment. So Juneteenth being recognized under Biden, we did that, he didn't. But because of what was going on with George Floyd and the pandemic, we did that. We created that groundswell that caused Biden to quickly grab Juneteenth out the air and make it a national holiday. And it was really to try to demobilize us because we were so mobilized with the George Floyd protest. The way you undermine it is give somebody a little piece of meat. So they gave us a little piece of meat called Juneteenth. Now, to me, the question is, what does Black America do going forward? There it is. It's now law. Juneteenth. We know Juneteenth. Juneteenth recognizes the abolition of slavery overall and in Texas. Now that we know that as a Black people in the 21st century, do we sit back and just celebrate Juneteenth? Or do we politicize Juneteenth? Do we get behind Juneteenth and say, that's the basis of our reparations? There it is. You are acknowledging it with the holiday. Therefore, we want federal reparations. That's how I see it. So I think what has to happen now in San Francisco, for example, somebody like me or Reverend Brown or somebody on the committee needs to make some noise in San Francisco and say we should give $75,000 to every black person over 65 now. And I'm going to do it if somebody else doesn't do it soon. To just start some trouble, I'm going to write an editorial in the Chronicle or somewhere here locally to start some trouble to keep it going. But that's my point. If reparations fails, it's because we didn't do anything else other than what we did. If y'all stop now and say, oh, they didn't get nothing in California. Oh, they didn't get nothing in San Francisco. Oh, they didn't get nothing in New York. It's your fault because we did the work. We created the case. Nobody called anywhere in America now can intelligently publicly oppose reparations. Nobody can intelligently publicly oppose reparations. Whoever would have to be a Negro so contorted and tortured and twisted like a pretzel trying to make sense out of the case that has been made by Darity and Mullen in their book From Here to Equality. That book makes the case for reparations $17 to $18 trillion from the federal government. It answers every question that they've ever put to us about what about the Indians and what about the Irish and what about that and what about this. So the case has been made. The case was made by Ta-Nehisi Coates when he wrote the case for reparations. So the case has been made. Now the question is, what does Black America for the rest of the 21st century do about reparations? Do you let the Democrats put it aside, or do you demand the Democrats recognize reparations? If Joe Biden would say reparations, the race would be over. If Trump said reparations,
Biden would be in trouble. Whoever says reparations first in 2024, or whoever doesn't, will feel it. Bernie made the case for reparations. Bernie kept talking about the 1%, the 99% Occupy. Bernie would talk about all of these indices and then say black folk were at the bottom. And then you ask Bernie, what about reparations? Then all of a sudden, Bernie, who is Jewish, who knows about reparations in Israel, would say no. His Marxism, his socialism won't let him support reparations. I don't know why, but that's Bernie's position. And so my point is...
And hold that thought right there. That's an important point that you mentioned, Dr. Taylor, because people don't know, many people don't know that. It's 26 minutes away from the top there. Bob in Philly has a question for you when we get back. I'll take a quick break. We're back in 4 minutes right here in Baltimore on 1010 WLB. If you're in the DMV, we're on FM 95.9 and AM 1450. WOL, where information is power. And thanks for waking up with us, family. At 22 minutes away from the top there with Dr. James Taylor. Dr. Taylor is a black politics expert. As I told you before we left, Bob in Philly has a question. He's been holding. He's on line one. Good morning, Bob. You're on with Dr. Taylor.
Hey, Brother Carl, Brian in Philly. Hey, but anyway, for your guest, what does he think about a referendum in order to hold politicians accountable by actually reducing the amount of money that they get, not only as far as getting paid from their income, but as well as their pensions? Because a lot of politicians, they'll go and be in one office and get in another office and then another office. They get like three and four pensions from different, you know, spots that they held offices in. And then by the time they got in, did what they needed to do for 4 years, either they messed it up to benefit us or they did make it good for us. And then the next person gets in the next 4 years and mess it up for what they did. So what does he think about a referendum to hold politicians accountable so we can actually get some of the money that they've been receiving off of us based on supporting them in order to go back to resources that we really need as the people? I'll take my answer off.
I wish we could direct funds in that way, but it's actually unconstitutional for Congress to actually, but that's more to the Supreme Court. Like Congress, for example, can't play with the Supreme Court justices' salaries, how much they earn, because they don't like the Supreme Court. So there are constitutional protections from even some salaries, I'm saying, are protected for government workers in the Constitution in general. It doesn't itemize like, you know, if you're the Secretary of State or if you're the Secretary of Transportation, but it gives the big idea that Congress has control of the purse and Congress can set salaries and adjust salaries. For example, in the 70s, 80s, 90s, the president made $200,000. That's basically a middle-class income. When George Bush came the second time, the son, his second term, Bush, the salary of the president of the United States increased from $200,000 to what it is now, $400,000, which still is not a lot of money considering what the president does, say, compared to a basketball player. But that's what it is. So those things are internal, you know, party politics, system politics, bureaucratic politics, with bylaws and insider, you know, benefits and advantages that probably go way beyond anything we can really impact. But now, so I'm going to change the subject a little bit, Carl, if I can. And that the few minutes we have left, I did want to talk a little bit about the idea that, you know, a lot of people don't appreciate. When you hear a lot of these people, like Tariq Nasheed, or let's say some of these independent, you know, people like Kanye West or Ice Cube, as they run around, sadly for them, independent thinking always ends up leading them into the laps of right wingers. And I don't understand that about, you know, Ice Cube or Kanye. If you are going to be a black independent thinker, how is it that it makes you wear a MAGA hat? Like this idiot Charleston White from Texas with the one eye open. This fool runs around with a MAGA hat with a Confederate jacket on. And it's like, how is it that your independent mind always leads you to become a black racist? Like, you know, from the movie Boondocks, the uncle on Boondocks. How did it make you end up acting like that rather than an independent? What you hear from me is an independent-minded black man. I don't belong to either party, and I'm not co-signing either party. I'm co-signing where black people are. But when you look at Kanye or Candace Owens or Ice Cube, who I do like, whenever they articulate their independent politics, getting off the plantation, as they like to call it, they always end up in the lap of the KKK or some racist organization. But it's important to know, a lot of these people will tell you not to vote, not because they have good reason for you not to vote. Many of them don't vote because their own mothers didn't vote. And that's what I'm saying. If you ask Tariq Nasheed, did your mama vote? Ask Ice Cube, did your mother vote? Ask anybody who's running around discouraging people, those who are running around saying, oh, you're a Democrat. The Democratic Party ain't did nothing for black people. We know the game, but we also know that that parental education impacts voting turnout. So there are studies after studies called, here are some of the titles, The Influence of Parents on the Political Attitudes of Their Adolescents. Another topic, Politics Across Generations, Family Transmissions Reexamined. Another study, Families' Role in Political Socialization. Another study, The Family and Voter Turnout. Another study, How Parents Speak with Their Children. And so all of these articles you can find in Google Scholar, and it shows that voting behavior is a reflection of your parents educating you of the importance of voting behavior. If your mama didn't vote, then you don't vote. Very few people vote whose parents didn't vote. If your mama or grandmother or uncles or aunts were civic-minded black people and decided we're going to always vote because we fought for the right to vote and we know what it means, then that is transferred to children and transmitted. And it's a major variable. The other is the kids' education itself. So you can't just be, your parents can't be civic-minded and you be stupid. If your parents are civic-minded, you have to be a decent student around civics to be involved. Because children see observation and consistency, and it's learned behavior to vote. So when a parent is involved, when both your parents vote, you are 44% more likely to vote than if your parents don't vote. If you got a mother and father who both vote, you're almost 50% more likely to vote than somebody whose parents don't vote. On top of that, if you got two parents, one does vote and one does not vote, the voting parent still tends to have the most influence in the family over civic participation and voting. And especially mothers, the research shows mothers, because of the way they talk to children in terms of development, developing personality, childhood development, encouraging dialogue and discourse, compared to men who tend to be more silent at least in the old days, the children get more information from the mother than they do the father, because the mother tends to be encouraging. Voting and parental voting impacts the child's voting. So the parent socializes the child by saying it's important to vote. Carl, I got this from my own life. Even the topic, if your mama didn't vote, you don't vote. I made that up. And I got it from the fact that all my life, my mother, who's now dead, my mother died 7 years ago yesterday. My mother voted all my life. When I was a kid, my mother dragged us along. I watched my mother vote a single black woman in the projects with a high school education who did not graduate high school. My mother never graduated high school. And my mother taught me the importance of voting. I watched her vote all my young life. And guess what? I vote as much as I possibly can. And now my children are watching me vote. And if they see me voting and their mom voting, then my children are going to be more civic minded. If they don't see me vote, then that's what happens. So a lot of people who are running around with this laissez-faire, blase, indifference, or going out of their way to say, don't participate, don't vote, the Democrats ain't going to do nothing for you, ask them if their grandmama voted. And I guarantee you, if you sit around a table with a bunch of intelligent people and ask them, how did your parents vote? Did your mama vote? How often do we as black people have this conversation? We don't, because we don't know how our culture really interacts with the big idea of voting apart from those who actually participate. In other words, there are those who are involved in politics, but there's a much larger black group of people who don't engage in politics at all on a daily basis. So the question then becomes, if your mother encouraged you, you're probably more likely you know, to engage in voting. Voting behavior is because of your parents' influence. Parental example matters. Parental education impacts turnout of adult children. So well-educated parents transmit responsibility of voting and participation to their children. And so this is what is important. A child's voting habits, it can also influence the parent. You know, like we saw that with Obama, and when all of those young white kids around America were trying to convince their racist parents, hey, you can vote for the black guy, it's okay. That was a big thing when Obama ran, the white kids persuading their conservative elders to vote for the black guy. So white kids, you know, not white kids, the youth can also impact the elders voting if some, you know, interesting personality comes along to run for office and everybody's like curious about him, like an Obama. You know, young people can have that influence. So again, I think this is really important for black people to understand, because we don't have these conversations that often about voting behavior and voting conduct and voting attitudes. And I'm saying to you, a good measure of when you hear people being negative about participation, ask them, do they do jury duty? Because that's another way you can participate. When you did, okay, you don't vote. Did you do jury duty this year? If that person says no to voting and jury duty, they have no civic mindedness. They're not civically minded. Did you donate to a candidate? Have you volunteered at a community center? That same person is the person that won't vote. Why? Because they didn't see their mama vote. They didn't see their mama volunteer at the community center. So a lot of times when you think your politics are your politics, they're just the politics that your parents and your family and community socialized in you. The more you participate, it is a reflection of the fact that your mother, more than your father, participated in politics. So if you think it's because you're independent-minded, it may be that you actually are influenced by your mom to vote. And then the question is, how do you vote after that? But the idea of voting, the idea of civic participation comes from well-educated parents giving that idea to their children.
All right, turning away from the topic. Dante is calling from Baltimore. He has a question for you. He's on line one. Good morning, Dante.
Hey, good morning. Good morning. Pleasure to speak to both of you gentlemen who are enlightening the community. I wanted to ask a quick question. How do you think that right now would be an immediate way to be able to use AI and technology right now to affect the younger generation? Like I said, I have a lot of friends that are 40 or under. And like I was just talking to about 10 of them yesterday, and all of them said that they were kind of leaning towards Donald Trump. So I went through a whole spiel of how dumb can you be. And it was just weird to think that they don't understand that the Republicans are taking their, you know, child care, you know, like Head Start programs, all types of programs that affect the black community. So it's weird, but the social media and the internet are getting to them because they don't even know about the insurrection. I always ask all black guys under 40, do you know about the insurrection? Do you know what a conservative is? Do you know about all those different things that they are, even affirmative action? Nobody has a clue. So I just want to know, what is it that you could think that we could possibly do to try to affect them now? Because like I said, I can't do it. I'm not cool enough. You need somebody that's kind of cool, that understands the reality of what's going on, to be able to get to them, because they're lost. Like, I'm telling you, 40 right. and under.
We're running out of time. I'll give Dr. Taylor a chance to respond. No, thanks, Dante. Good question.
I think it's a call to service. I think you're pointing out a gap and what needs to be done. And that's my point. If somebody's sitting back complaining about the conversation around voting and we don't get anything out of it, then my question is, do you do anything else? Do you do jury duty? Do you do volunteerism? Are you committed to civil society? You know, wake up black civil society. That's what the Panthers did best. Not the confrontation with the police, but what made the Panthers dangerous was the ambulatory services, the sickle cell programs, the breakfast programs. Meeting the needs of the people is what we need. And, you know, for me, I'm old school, so my attitude is, you know, can ChatGPT or AI solve any problem? Can it solve the problem of racism or poverty or infrastructure? So far, all they've told us is it's the monster, the devil, that's going to be a robot that's going to come back and kill us like it's a mad movie, right? The original AI is bringing out racism, just like facial recognition technology. Imagine that, the 21st century technology that allows you to discover, you know, to fingerprint somebody's face, and the first thing that comes out of it is racism. So AI, again, just like regular intelligence, like human intelligence, always finds that, you know, the humans behind AI. And if there's a human heart that's racist, then they'll find a way to make AI work against us. But, you know, it's neutral. AI is neutral. AI can be used positively or negatively. And the question is, do we have a generation of young Black people who will rise up and take the lead in these areas in ways that would benefit Black people in the same way Thurgood Marshall and others jumped up when it came to fighting for civil rights? We need a generation of young people to take the lead in that area, is my point, who can help set whatever AI is going to be with Black people on its course.
That's my last question to you. Is there a group of young adults or average Americans that you can think of, Black Americans, that are doing what the Black Panther Party did? I know there's a Black Panther Party around, something like that, but not as savvy and smart as the ones that were back then. Not that those guys aren't like that, but I'm just saying, is there a party that can support now?
Dante, real quick, Doc, because we got about a minute.
My man.
The thing is, but I tell you to read the body of work of Howard Cruz. Read his book, Rebellion or Revolution. Get that book, Rebellion or Revolution, by Howard Cruz, and you'll see. He explains that Black Power was a move towards conservatism. It wasn't a move towards revolution. It was actually the Panthers moving back in the conservative direction Malcolm X had just left out of the nation. They went back into it, and he says by 74 in Arkansas, the emptiness of the Black Power slogan was left there to bear, because after all of the talk about Black Power going back to 1966, by 1974, it was organized around these conventions, and nothing came out of it. So I think the blueprint, the infrastructure for the Panthers was a good idea, but that moment has come and gone. Black Lives Matter should start off where the Black Panthers ended.
And Doc, we're just about out of time. How can folks follow you real quick?
They can find me at JamesTaylor1699 on Instagram. JamesTaylor1699 on Instagram. Thanks so much, Carl.
Thank you, Dr. Taylor. Family, we got to get out of here. We're done for the day. Stay strong. Stay positive. Please, please stay healthy. We'll see you tomorrow morning, 6 o'clock, right here in Baltimore on 1010 WLB, and also in the DMV on FM 95.9 and AM 1450 WOL, where information is power.